Hello and welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. Today, we take the show in a slightly different direction. My guest is a writer, but he uses notes and staves rather than words. A musician, he shot to fame in the 70s as the lead guitarist with the seminal band Roxy Music. He's also a record producer who's worked with some of the biggest musicians in the world. His latest project is a multi-genre, multi-generational and multinational collection of songs, which took place remotely with his collaborator in New Zealand. Phil, most people don't know your real name is actually Phil Target Adams.
That is correct. That was my father's name, very British gentleman. And my mother was Colombian from Barranquilla, Colombia, and her name was Magdalena Manzanera.
And she was musical.
She was musical because she, in fact, taught me how to play guitar. Well, a little bit of how to play what they call accompagnamiento, which is accompanying yourself when you're singing, and particularly songs from Cuba, where I started having lessons from her, so to speak. If you could call having a 6-year or 7-year old touching her guitar, saying, "Get off the guitar, I'll show you some chords." Those are the lessons. But in Havana, in 1958.
Because it was a pretty itinerant childhood. I mean, your father worked for BOAC?
My father worked for BOAC, which was British Overseas Airways Corporation, which the British government owned at the time. And he was sent to Havana to open up the new office, hopefully for a new route to Havana. But, you know, he'd started the British Council when the British Council started around 1938-39, was sent to Colombia and then to Argentina during the Second World War, and pretty much was a spy, really. And one thing I discovered recently was that when Graham Greene was writing Our Man in Havana, he was about 100 metres away from my dad's office, and he was MI6. So the plot thickens. I also have some Super 8 footage in our garden with the then British consul in Havana, and I showed it to him before he died about 10 years ago, because my father died in 1965. And I said, "Who are those people in our garden?" And he said, "Spooks." So watch this space. I've been, you know, we always seem to live in somewhere where there was trouble.
That's extraordinary. I love that idea that your father was this spy that was taking his little sons around the world with him.
Well, they were in Argentina during Perón, during the famous Battle of the River Plate, which was a very famous battle where the German Nazi destroyer was scuttled, actually, which was causing havoc. We were all getting our food from places like Argentina during the Second World War. And it was flip-flopping, you know, Perón. And so there was culture wars going on in Argentina between the Goethe Institute and the French equivalent and the British Council. Everyone was, like, pushing their side of arts and literature and stuff. It just shows you how important the cultural side of influence was in the whole world. But yeah, and we were researching my dad, actually, a few years ago, and the papers to his boss in Argentina when he returned to England, there was this letter that said, "Go to this bookshop in Charing Cross Road, get this particular book and send it to me." And it's real spy stuff. You know, they used to go to particular books and get codes and things like that. So anyway, one of the many things that I'm researching at the moment.
Absolutely fascinating stuff. You came back to England and you ended up at Dulwich College and you were playing music there. And in fact, your first bands were formed at school.
That's right. Well, actually, I first, when I was in Venezuela, living in Caracas, before I asked my parents to send me to England to go to boarding school, because I was fed up with having rice and beans and fried bananas. I wanted baked beans and sausages and things like that. You know, that was my main thrust of although I used to listen to the World Service and hear, you know, Cliff Richard and the Shadows in the early 60s. And by that stage, I had a Venezuelan friend who got an electric guitar. And because I was at school in Caracas, and in the holidays, or vacations, as they used to say, American students used to come over and they would play at parties. And they would play Buddy Holly and Chuck Berry stuff. And we saw all the girls from our class looking at these guys. And so me and my Venezuelan friend said, we've got to tool up. We've got to learn get electric guitars, start learning C, A minor, F, G. You know, let's get going. And then a logical consequence of that, I want to go to England. Yeah, I went to South London. And yeah, I'd learned so much from other boys at school at Dulwich. And yeah, started forming bands. And that was the beginning, really.
You auditioned for Roxy Music. Tell me about that.
I'll tell you what happened. My father died in Venezuela, 1965. We came back to live in London, but I continued being a boarder at Dulwich. And I said to my mother, sure, I'll continue doing exams and stuff, but I want to be a rock musician, pop musician. She was a lovely little lady from Barranquilla, hardly spoke English. Hey, rock music? Yeah, sort of cumbia, yes, or salsa, but rock, what's this? And my brother, who had been at Cambridge, said, look, tell you what, let's go and there's a guy who's just joined a band. He's become a professional musician. Let's go and have lunch with him, ask him what you have to do to become a professional musician. I was 16 at the time. And it was David Gilmour, who had just joined the Pink Floyd, literally a month before, had joined Pink Floyd. So he can't remember what he said, but he said it must have been good because you eventually joined Roxy Music 5 years later. But yeah, so I saw an ad in the Melody Maker. I've still got the ad. You know, wanted, quality musician or something, you know, tricky, this, that, the other. So, you know, I got in touch and I'd seen an article about them the week before in Melody Maker. Shows you the power of the press, doesn't it? And so I went along and I met this tiny little house in Battersea where Andy Mackay and Brian Ferry were sharing a little house. They were both teachers. Andy was teaching music at Holland Park Comprehensive. Brian was teaching pottery at a girls' school in Clapham. Yeah, we won't go on. And they were very grown up. They were about 6 or 7 years older than me. Had been to uni, had bank accounts, had cars, little cars, tiny cars, actually, a mini. They'd taken seats out the back to put amps in and things. And I met Eno there. And it was a wonderful day. And I thought, these guys, they're just like amazing. I want to be part of this. So we had a jam and they weren't the best musicians in the world. They could play like a couple of chords. And I was delighted because I'd been in a prog rock band playing very complicated music. So I thought, this is wonderfully liberating. I think we may have jammed on a Carol King song or something. It's not really highfalutin stuff, but I got on very well with them. I remember talking to Brian Ferry a lot about films because I was really into films and movies and things. And so I failed the audition. Yeah, they got someone else. They were looking for someone with a name. Well, Brian was. And it sort of backfired on them because it was this great guitarist called Dave O'List who was in a band called The Nice. Fantastic band. I'd seen them play at the Albert Hall. And Dave O'List was a great guitarist. I thought, well, fair enough. He's a proper professional musician, you know. It didn't work out with him. And then a few months later, they said, will you come and have a go? And Eno will teach. In fact, they said, come and have a go at mixing the sound. I said, well, I know nothing about mixing sound. I said, well, Eno will teach you. Because actually Eno's been banned from being on stage because he makes everyone too nervous. So he's out in the audience with the mixing desk. So I said, really? So I went to this derelict house in Notting Hill. And this old guitarist hasn't turned up. There's a guitar. Do you want to have a go? And that was a secret way of them trying me out again. But I, being, as it said in the ad, tricky and clever, had learnt all the stuff the night before. So when they said, can you play this number? I said, okay, show it to me. And after once, I said, right, stop there. Let's play it. And I played it, and it's happened on all the tracks. And I got the job straight away. The following Wednesday, I joined the band. I think 2 days later, we signed the first contract with Island Records. 6 weeks later, we're in the studio recording. And 8 weeks later, it was number four in the charts. I was just in the right place at the right time. Next year, it'll be 50 years. It's 50 years later.
Phil, I want to explore the writing side of this, because, of course, you are a composer, you're a producer. Tell me about writing.
Well, we're in this little room here, and it's very important when you're writing, I think, to have daylight. So it becomes very organic and natural. And basically, I sit here, and I have computer software and stuff, so I can record myself. And I, in this particular room, and because of COVID and everything, I've simplified everything. So I have one amplifier, one microphone, a bunch of guitars, and a little interface. And what I tend to do is to not think. First of all, I don't think about what I'm going to do. I try and not think about it. I just play. Whatever happens, happens. So it's this sort of a chaos theory, really. I just play and I record it. And then I'll play another track. And maybe I'll play like 20 tracks on top of each other. And then I will go through it all, panning for gold, seeing if there's an idea there or something. And then I will then use craftsmanship, which is stuff I've acquired over the last 50 years, to hone down the idea. And then I will go onto the computer and do things that you're not meant to do. On purpose, I will look for the weirdest instruments from all around the world and drag them into what I've just done and put them against other things. So it's a bit like, maybe it's a bit like painting or something, but with sound. You create a sort of a rough sort of pitch, and then you look at it and you see, or you listen to it, and you see if there's a musical idea there that's interesting. But that is the way I've developed it. So it doesn't start with a top line and a melody in a conventional songwriting sense. And so it's led me to very different types of music. And, you know, sometimes over the years there have been times when I've wanted to actually express words and my feelings with words in songs. And then that happened for about three albums worth. And then I thought, oh, I've got nothing left to say here. So I will now work with other writers who are going to sing their own words, because I always think that the person writing the song should sing his own words. So I'm not a conventional jobbing songwriter in that sense. I'm not interested in that.
Why did you feel you had nothing left to say? And I wonder how that relates to the music. I mean, some people say that there are no original songs left either, that it's just a constant reinvention.
Well, I think it's because the people that I admire as songwriters, so it's Bob Dylan, Leonard Cohen, Neil Young, or Joni Mitchell, people who actually are very good with words tend to talk about their own experiences and maybe fashion it in a very poetic way. I always considered myself as a sort of primitive type, so not a conventional type songwriter. So I had some things that I wanted to say when I was aged between 40 and 50. and I said them all. They're in those like 30 songs there. You know, I talked about loss, about living through the Cuban Revolution. I talked about all sorts of things. And then I thought, lyrically, I don't have anything interesting to say that's personal. So I'm not good at commenting on maybe on generalities about love, death and things like that. Other people are much better and more poetic. You know, I got out, there's a line from a José Martí poem, which is, of course, José Martí was the liberator of Cuba, who really, Guantanamera song, they use a lot of his poetry in it. Echar mis versos al aire, to put my words out into the air, if you like. And sort of I felt that I'd done that with my own three albums, and I would be better suited creating musical contexts for other people to inhabit with their words, especially singers. So, you know, that has led me to this point right here now, which is working with Tim Finn, who was in Split Enz and Crowded House and stuff, who, you know, has co-written some of my favourite songs, like Four Seasons in One Day, It's Only Natural, the Weather With You, you know, some of the biggest Crowded House, with his brother, Neil, obviously. And I feel that he is a proper sort of literate, if you like, songwriter, and has that Irish tradition, actually, from his family background. And so I am very good at creating musical context. And in fact, that's what I helped contribute with Brian Eno for Roxy.
Let's talk about this project, because it goes back to the 1970s.
It does. I first met Tim, it was the first Roxy Music Tour of Australia, 1975, and we had arrived in Sydney, this incredibly long journey that you used to take back then, and you were absolutely exhausted when you got there, and you get into the hotel room, flop on the bed, turn on the telly, which is the first thing most musicians do when they get into a hotel.
I thought they were meant to throw them out the window.
Yes. Not Roxy, obviously. And appeared on the screen this band Split Enz, who had just come over from New Zealand. And they were really wild and wacky and dressed in a bizarre way. And I just couldn't believe it wasn't what I was expecting. And then I go to the sound check the next day of the gig we're going to do, and they are the support band. So I watched them from the side of the stage, and I thought, wow, they're really good. So I popped my head into the dressing room when they came off and said, if there's anything I can do to help, just let me know. And I walked on, and a little head popped out. Will you produce our album? And in fact, they were already on this trajectory of recording their first album. But to their credit or whatever, they came to London, and we re-recorded the whole thing in Basing Street Studios. And so I've known them since 1975. And Neil was too young to be in the band there, but he was about 15 or 16. But then he, while they were in England for 2 years, he came over and joined Split Enz, in fact. And so over the years, they worked on... Actually, Tim and Neil worked on a solo album I did in 1976... And then maybe every 5 or 6 years, I'd see them again. They would help on different of my solo albums. And it's been ongoing. I bump into them all over the place. And then 2 years ago, when Roxy Music were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, on the same evening, Stevie Nicks was being inducted. And the whole of Fleetwood Mac were on a table next to us. And by that stage, Neil Finn had taken over Lindsey Buckingham's part for the last Fleetwood Mac tour. So he was there as well. We went to a party afterwards and had my picture taken with him. And I sent it to Tim. I said, look who I found in New York. And that started us again, you know, having conversations over email. And then when lockdown first happened, I'm sitting in this room on the screensaver. I do have a picture of an island in the Pacific, and up pops an email from a guy on an island in the Pacific. Tim Finn say, have you got any slow Latin grooves I can write stuff to? And that was it, you know. So because of the time difference between Auckland and the UK, so a 12-hour time difference, their nighttime is our, you know, it's daytime here, it's nighttime there. I did have some Latin grooves, and I started sending them to him. And then I'd wake up the next morning, and up would pop an email with him singing on them with words. And after 8 of these tracks, I couldn't believe it. The guy was just so incredibly talented, and it was just the right moment, the right time. We had no intention of doing an album or anything. It just kept going and going. And so we now have 24 of these tracks. So after I exhausted all the Latin stuff, I thought, well, I've got some sort of chamber music type stuff. I'll send it to him. He'll never be able to write something like that. Yep, came back. So he sort of, thrown down the gauntlet. I said, right, I've got a really weird track. I'm going to send it to him. He never. Yep, came back with him. So it was just happenstance, serendipity. This sort of lockdown and slowing down of stuff meant that we were all stuck at home. And it was very therapeutic, really. And it showed this wonderful level of interconnectedness with people through circumstances. So I started getting in touch with friends in California, in Bogota, in Argentina, and they all played on the album. I'd just send them stuff. And if they didn't know how to use the software, I'd say, you're going to have to learn how to use this thing called Logic Pro. I had some friends in Stuttgart and stuff. I said, I will buy it for you. You're going to have to teach yourself how to record yourself. And so we've ended up with, you know, musicians from 12 different countries, from Johannesburg, all sorts of people on this record. And, you know, it doesn't sound like it wasn't recorded altogether.
I mean, is this a world first, do you think?
Well, no, I don't know. I think this is going to become evident now over the next few years how many people have been working this way. Because musicians, you know, will find a way through to do their job, if you like. We've all had to do that. We've all had to learn how to do our job in some sort of way. But, you know, when you think about it, the way recording has changed, the process of recording has changed over the last 50 years, it means that now this isn't so unusual, because what used to happen is that people used to all go into a studio and all play together if they had a band or they had an orchestra and stuff like that. And then gradually it became, well, we'll go into the studio and record, but we'll only keep the bass and the drums, and then we'll overdub. As technology increased and you were able to use more tracks, we'll be able to do your part separately and concentrate on your part later. So you were doing it in bits and pieces anyway. And, you know, the logical, technological consequence of all this is now you can just do it all on a computer. Mm-hmm. And you can do it when you like. And that presents a whole lot of extra problems technically of, like, choice, because you're no longer limited by the number of tracks you use. Whereas before you had eight tracks, four tracks, eight tracks, 24 tracks. And then they invented computers.
I wonder about the content of the songs, because it seems to me they very much reflect this time we've been living through in a lovely positive way, actually. There's a kind of theme of hope and interconnectedness through them.
Yes, well, the first track I sent him became the track called Vamos Despacio, Let's Go Slow. And when I heard what he'd done with it straight away, I thought, this is so appropriate to the mood of what's happening at the moment. You know, we're all in this lockdown. We've had to slow down. We've had to think about different priorities. And he got his inspiration for this track from a cartoonist in Australia called Michael Lunig, who has this cartoon of this character called the Plodder. And he is quite a comical sort of character who does everything in slow. So he's walking along a street and they say, hurry up, you're going to miss the bus. I don't care. And then the next thing is, yes, but you'll lose out on the thing. So what? You know, so his response to everything was, I'm going slow, I'm just going at my pace. And that seemed to fit the mood. And so, you know, the music that I sent him made him think of this as a subject matter. And in fact, you know, a lot of the tracks that were, and the reason why he asked about Latin grooves was because he knew of my upbringing in Cuba during, you know, the 57, 56 to 59. And he had visited Cuba in the 80s and been struck by basically which the life force that is Cuban music. It's very up and it's about dancing. And it's also baffling how it's structured for most European musicians. When you try and analyze it, things aren't on the 1, 2, 3, 4 beats of the bar. They're all over the place. And that is to do with African rhythms. and it's to do with religion, Santeria, and it's to do with percussion and congas and timbales and maracas and claves, and they sort of mean something in Santeria. The religious rhythms, that's what they're fiendishly complicated, the wawanko, as they call it. And, you know, he'd been fascinated by that and had been to Cuba. So it was a sort of nostalgia for him about remembering those times, you know, when everybody was locked down, everything. Everybody starts revisiting all sorts of aspects of their life and things like that. So he had this yearning for it. So, you know, one, the first track on the album, which is called Mambo Salsa, is really like a dreamscape where all these characters who were famous, whether it's Celia Cruz and Tito Puente, and also film actresses like Brigitte Bardot and Sophia Loren, who were in films. I mean, the famous Mambo Italiano is mentioned in the lyrics, and that is, there's a wonderful film with Sophia Loren dancing mambo and stuff. So it pulled together all these aspects which had, you know, I kept saying to him, this has huge resonance for me. You know, I was there when all these people who became famous later with the Buena Vista Social Club were at their prime and playing in clubs and casinos. You know, and I was taken to the Tropicana Club as a sleepy sort of seven-year-old while the parents were all there. I was like asleep on the table, and I remember being sort of shoved in the car afterwards, you know. But I was living all those great dances and dancing and things like this, and it's all in there. And it's a nice time for all this to come out. So with the help of Tim, you know, and his ability to write in a very succinct and a very observed way about issues. So the music varied from Latin music to like reggae and almost like Spanish goth music. The second track, for instance, is a sort of really about environmental issues. And that was because he had gone to this place called Bougainville, which I'd never heard of before. It's a place in Papua New Guinea where there was this copper mine which had been decimated, really, and the earth had been cut open. It reminded him of, he'd been doing music for a film, so he went to this place. And when I Googled all about it, you know, there's huge articles in The Guardian and stuff about the environmental disaster that was created there and still is. And it caused a mini war. And so the cry of the earth really came from, he juxtaposed that with a Russian riddle. They cut me, they burn me, they hurt me, who am I? And of course it's the earth, the cry of the earth. So, you know, he's a wonderful person to work with, you know, on that level, as well as being a great singer. So, you know, I felt this project is the most accomplished sort of song kind of project that I've ever done, really.
It's wonderful, and we will listen, I think, to a track now.
Mambo if you're down with Tito Puente, salsa if you're down with Celia Cruz, music from Cuba, still a life force, bumping down the avenue.
Mambo! Salsa! Mambo! Salsa!
Phil, tell me, this is being released as an EP. Can people also get it on vinyl?
It's actually being released as a CD now, because an album. Because what happened is that we did release an EP, and we were going to release a whole series of EPs, and then the reaction was very good. And we thought, well, hang on, we've got 24 tracks. Why don't we just make an album straight away and put the second album out next February or something with the other tracks? So, yeah, on the 27th of August, the album comes out. And I decided to make some physical albums apart from having it available on all digital platforms. I thought, actually, some people do like CDs because it's a global thing, this. And I would have liked to have done some vinyl, but there's an incredibly difficult shortage of vinyl. So eventually there will be a vinyl of maybe both the albums next year and stuff like that. And that's it. You know, we will I said, you know, we've done 24 tracks. Let's not do any more because it'd go on forever. So it's a neat sort of, you know, project. But I'm very, so far, the reaction has been very encouraging from people because it's quite different. You know, it doesn't look at the charts at the moment and say, right, this has got a rapping bit in it and this has got a hip-hoppy bit in it. And this, you know, it's not trying too hard at all, you know. So it's like, yeah, vamos despacio, let's go slow.
Caught by the Heart by Phil Manzanera and Tim Finn is out now. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Nora Hall and Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, MixCloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.